All rise. The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, we have a couple of preliminary matters before we begin with the second case. My notes tell me that we have the students from Classical Conversations Homeschool here. If that's the case, would they stand, please? Oh, very nice. You may be seated. We are pleased to have the homeschoolers join us. They are participating in a program that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. So they've gotten some of the information about the case that you're going to argue to us in a few minutes. And after this matter is concluded, Justice Annette Ziegler, who sits right there, will come out and speak with the students a little bit, not about the substance of the case, but more about how cases reach the Supreme Court and to answer those kinds of questions. So if you can remain, that would be great. Anyone else who would like to attend Justice Ziegler's conversation with the students is certainly welcome to do that. We have a couple of empty chairs on the bench today. On my right, Justice Shirley Abrahamson usually sits. She is with us by telephone. So if you hear a voice coming out of the clouds, it's just Justice Abrahamson asking a question. Justice Kelly, however, sits at the far side of the bench down this direction. He is not participating in this case today. So we sit six. I also see that you've gotten a little bit of a different lineup time-wise, and I want to go over it with you so I'm sure that we're all on the same page. Attorney Nowicki, you will start with 25 minutes and then proceed to Attorney Whalen for 15 minutes and then Attorney Shanker for another 15 minutes. I also understand that Attorney Shanker, who is a member of the Arizona Bar, is going to be introduced. So before we begin our presentation, I prefer that occur now, counsel, and I understand you have Attorney Amanda White Eagle here to take care of that. Attorney, will you please approach the podium?
May it please the court, my name is Amanda White Eagle. I'm the Ho-Chunk Nation Attorney General. Arguing on our behalf will be Attorney Shanker, who has been admitted pro hoc vice and a member of good standing in the state of Arizona.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and we welcome your participation, counsel. Okay, I think we're all set to go. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. My name is Brian Nowicki. My co-counsel, Amy McCarty, and I represent Wingra Ready Mix in this matter. Wingra is appealing the Burial Sites Preservation Board's decision to deny Wingra's request to remove certain of Wingra's property from a state-maintained catalog of burial sites. We ask that this court reverse the board's decision. This case is about unaccountable administrative overreach, where an agency favored its preferences over the legislative mandate and did so in a way that, if the agency were to have its way, a person adversely affected by that agency decision could not seek relief in court. We would ask this court to rein in the tools used by that agency or other agencies by which they attempt to accomplish that kind of overreach and ensure that agencies comport with the limits of their legislative mandate. Specifically in this case, the legislature enacted the Burial Sites Preservation Law at Section 157.7.
Also, as I was preparing for this, what I was struck by is the facts that are in dispute. You say it boils down. You have to excuse everyone my sore throat. It seems to me that there's a dispute over factual findings. Is that not the case? You're saying that there aren't enough facts to support the holding that it's a burial ground. And the agency is saying, and the tribe is saying, that there is enough evidence.
There is a difference there, but the difference comes in the context of standards that the board applied in this case that we believe were the inappropriate legal standards, which through the lens of the inappropriate standard, it allowed the facts to be misinterpreted and weighed in an inappropriate way that led to the denial of this. Had the appropriate standard been applied to what are in large part undisputed facts, then the decision of the board should have been to have granted Wingra's request.
Can you tie that up in a neat sentence for me?
The board expanded its the authority granted it by the legislature under the statute to allow the board to protect not just burial sites as mandated by the statute, but all effigy mounds in the state of Wisconsin, even those that do not have burial sites. It expressly goes beyond the...
Okay, but I still don't see... There were tests done. There was testing done that you say, or your client says, was ambiguous as to whether it's human remains or something else, right?
We believe that the testing done by Professor Frata demonstrated more likely than not that they were not human remains. That is the conclusion of his report.
Okay.
Isn't there a statutory standard that has to be met? So in order to have a site removed from the catalog as a burial site, you have to show, quote, sufficient evidence to indicate that the catalog site does not contain human remains, right?
That's not the statutory standard. That's the standard in the code provision that the board applied in this case.
Okay. Well, you're talking about what the section
2.0.
Okay. But is that you agree it is the standard that is applicable here?
That is the standard. The debate is about what that standard means.
Right. That's what I'm asking you. That's what we should be focusing on, is that standard.
It is that the interpretation of that standard, correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And that's because you can catalog under the then current statute, though apparently the statutes have changed, a site that does not contain human remains but is of archaeological interest.
That is true, or you can catalog a site that is likely to contain human remains under a different subsection.
Right. Okay. But everything that's in the catalog doesn't necessarily contain human remains.
I believe the catalog can be broader than containing human remains.
Okay. I understood from the briefing, and if I'm not on what you're really arguing, let me know. I understood that you wanted that evidence to be presented to be sort of a look back at the time they cataloged this site that's on Wingra's property. They should have made a determination of which it was, but there was no determination made, and you were prevented from having that considered at the hearing. Is that correct or not correct?
We believe that the board decided to, and through its arguments about the statute of limitations relating to the original cataloging decision in 1990, that the board hewed to that decision, even though we believe that decision was not well-founded by the facts, and under the regulation and the statute, there is no requirement that that decision remain undisturbed or unreviewed.
But I thought that the decision to catalog didn't have underpinnings particularized to whether there were or were not or might be human remains.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay, so I thought you wanted to present evidence where they had to look back at that. Otherwise, you almost get a presumption that it does contain human remains, and you had to prove that it didn't.
Well, we would argue that there is no presumption that it contains human remains merely because it's cataloged, given that catalog sites don't necessarily need to contain human remains. We would also argue that we did introduce evidence to the extent that was a presumption that overcame that specific to the Ward Mound Group, which is the particular set of Indian mounds at issue in this case.
Okay.
Now, your evidence, there were competing evidence, competing evidence was presented. As I read part of the transcript, one of the experts of the state
indicated something like this, that maybe 60-some percent of all 64, 66 percent of all effigy mounds that have been examined have burial remains. And another percentage was undetermined, but only like 10%, as I recall the testimony, was there not any burial remains. And so I know I read another place in the record that of all effigy mounds, at least 80% have burial remains. So, and your expert indicated that there were three anomalies on the property and wanted to further explore what those anomalies were. In essence, though, suggesting that the anomalies were not human remains. So we have competing evidence, apparently.
There is competing evidence. However, under the context of the statute, the evidence relating to effigy mounds generally is not an appropriate consideration. The evidence needs to relate specifically to the burial site at issue, where Professor Frata is the only evidence on that matter. So there are a lot of different interpretations of the statistics, and I think basing any legal determination on manipulable statistics is questionable in the first place. But when that consideration is directly contrary to the statutory command the statutory and regulatory command about looking at the burial site and having to have human remains in a burial site.
Unlike the case that we're going to hear a little later, this case deals with the cataloging. And it was cataloged in 1990. You had available, I think at that time, some options to contest the cataloging. Your opposing counsel would argue that, look, you didn't take those options that were available to you in 1990, and now you're trying to do the thing that you could have done and that was allowed for under the law. What's your response to that?
My response is that the statute puts no limitation on an ability of person to question the cataloging of a site. And, in fact, the regulation that we're operating under that allows for the removal of a site states that if evidence is ever presented to indicate that there are not human remains, it triggers a hearing process. We don't agree that 1990 decision was a legitimate decision. We have a lot of problems with that, but we don't need to overcome those in this particular case. What the regulation, the society's own regulation, commands the society to do is if ever evidence is presented, it is to take up this issue anew. What the society has contended is that in that process, the burden then falls on the proponent of removal to demonstrate a negative, the absence of human remains. We don't think that is the appropriate consideration either, or the allocation of the burden. In the society's brief, they make a statement, an argument that if they had decided to voluntarily reopen this matter, then the burden would have been theirs to try to prove the existence of human remains. But unless they decide to reopen it, the burden is on the proponent of removal. That leaves the allocation of the burden to the whim of the board. It can decide, based upon whether it wants to reopen or not, whether the burden is going to apply consistent with the statute on proving that there are remains present, or the burden is going to fall on a property owner who needs to prove something that the statute never requires, which is to prove the absence of remains.
I want to get a couple of things out of the way. I'll use the term housekeeping. That is, you agree that the standard of review here is de novo?
Yes.
Is, regardless of who has the burden, is the burden of proof preponderance of evidence?
I disagree that the regulation is clear about that being the burden of proof on a property owner.
Okay.
I don't think it's on a property owner.
Pardon?
I don't think that burden applies to the property owner.
Regardless of who the burden is, what's the standard then? I mean, is it a clear, satisfactory, and convincing? Is it, what standard are we dealing with here? Preponderance of evidence?
Yeah, I believe the burden of proof is on the state to demonstrate by a preponderance of the evidence.
Okay, and that's
there
it,
are
preponderance
human
of evidence, okay.
Based upon site-specific evidence.
As I was rereading the circuit court's opinion in this case, as I recall it, it indicated that since there's no specific allocation of burden, that you revert to the common law burden as to who has the burden and the burden going forward, and that the common law would be whoever is requesting a change of the status quo has the burden, and then the burden is preponderance of evidence. What's your response to that?
That proposition, and even the case that's been cited from the board forward, does not result in the burden appropriately being applied on the property owner. It's the, I think, the commitment of West case where they draw that from. And the specific sentence or language that they draw it from is merely the first part of a five-part test regarding what burden should apply. And it just talks about the natural tendency to place the burden on a party seeking change. That, in that particular case, I think it involved a parolee who was petitioning for his release. And the statute put the burden on the parolee to demonstrate a number of factors that would result in that patient, that person's release or extended release. The default under the law in that case was to deny the petition unless certain items were shown.
The administrative rule have the burden, or to speak to the burden, that is HS 2.03 sub 6?
It doesn't. It speaks to the sufficient evidence to indicate and to demonstrate a negative, but it doesn't speak to who has the ultimate burden in a way that's consistent with the statute.
Well, here it is. It says, in proceeding to determine whether a site should be removed from the catalog, and it was cataloged in 1990, so that's where we are, the burden of proof is upon the proponent of removal from the catalog to establish that there are no human remains at the site. And the proponent of removal, therefore, has the initial burden of coming forward with evidence sufficient to form the basis, and et cetera. And it talks about burden shifting. So it seems to me that HS 2.03 sub 6 does detail the burden, including the burden of going forward. And then a potential burden shift if there's sufficient evidence of no remains.
I still believe, Your Honor, that when you talk about what is sufficient evidence, that is a standard that is provided by the society in its own regulation. And for them to, I guess, at least in writing, equate it with a preponderance is an error, but also in the way they actually phrase the decision, they impose a burden much greater than preponderance, in effect requiring conclusive proof that there was the absence of human remains.
What I'm having a little bit of trouble with in sorting out your argument is Justice Bradley, you know, read to you from removal from the catalog. Okay. But some parts of your argument are focused on it shouldn't have been in the catalog. In other words, you can have something removed from the catalog that perhaps should have been cataloged, or you can have something removed from the catalog that's being relied on in a way that cataloging doesn't support. Am I making any sense to you? I'm concerned about separating out those two parts of what I think are your arguments.
I think with regard to the first part, the initial cataloging decision, where the board was able to catalog, or the society was able to catalog this with minimal proof, without a hearing, without an adverse proceeding, is not warranted to give that any weight or any presumptive effect, and it is subject to challenge. And therefore, when we come forward with a request to remove, where the evidence we present is site-specific, and it's the only site-specific evidence, it undermines the original cataloging decision. And then we need to see, well, what did they bring forward to contest the site-specific evidence? And what they brought forward were statistics regarding effigy mounds generally.
So if I understand what you're saying, it doesn't matter that it's cataloged. All we look at now is whether there is any proof that there are human remains there, and I think the administrative rule says sufficient evidence to indicate, which to me is an odd way of setting up a burden of proof, which is why I brought it up to you initially.
It is an odd way of phrasing it. It's not consistent. If they meant preponderance, they could have said preponderance.
Yeah, but
or
they
clear
didn't.
And
they didn't.
But
and to indicate is different than to prove.
Exactly, Your Honor. So it seems like a lower standard that they themselves imposed upon a proponent of removal, and yet when we get to the hearing, they elevate it to either preponderance or they elevate it to conclusive proof in their actual actions. So they're imposing, they see the regulation and the wording of the regulation, but their interpretation of it, they go far beyond what the regulation requires. And I would argue the regulation itself goes beyond what the statute imposes on which party needs to prove the existence of human remains.
Okay, so tie this regulation that Justice Bradley and I both looked at, which is subsection 6, to the statutory section that you think is exceeded by that regulation.
In the statutory section, is 157.72A, it's the duty the director has to catalog burial sites. That is the director's duty to identify and catalog those sites. It is no other person's obligation, and nobody else is required to provide any proof regarding that. And a burial site means any place where human remains are buried. So at no time does the statute waver from saying that the director must be able to demonstrate the existence of burial sites.
So you say that gives the director the burden in the initial get-go to show that this burial site contained human, or was a burial site under the statute, which just says that it contains human remains. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so you think that the subsection Justice Bradley and I were worrying about is inconsistent with that?
I believe so. To the extent it attempts to shift the burden to a private party to demonstrate a negative is inconsistent with the laws that the other side, that the society has cited to, the West case in particular, and the Reinke case, I believe, where the court questioned a party's ability to prove a negative, especially in a situation, or including an analysis of a situation where the other side had better access to evidence, which is what we found in this case, where we attempted to do additional searching or excavation or investigation into the burial mounds to determine the existence of human remains, and were turned away and were given inconsistent directions, maybe not inconsistent directions, but were led down two blind alleys where we were never able to meet the burden that they had set up for Wingra.
In fact, if I recall, in 2015, there was legislation that was introduced that would allow for the kind of thing that you're talking about, in other words, excavation in order to determine human remains, and that never got anywhere. Well, I guess it got a little ways, but it didn't come to fruition. I know that you were a proponent of that. Seems like that's kind of what you're requesting now. So why should we judicially write in to the statute what the legislature refused to do in the 2015 legislation, number one, and number two, now that we have April 2018 legislation? When I took a look at that legislation, I wanted to know if we should improvidently grant this case. And so those are two questions. Why should we judicially write in what the legislature refused to write in 2015 in the bill that didn't pass that would allow for excavation? And given that we now have this recent legislation to take care of future, to clarify future scope, why shouldn't we improvidently grant both questions?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. First, with regard to the permission to excavate, there needs to be no judicially created permission to do that. The regulation itself already included a provision that allowed the director to permit testing.
Wasn't that, though? See, I think you're 20 years too late or so, maybe 30 years, I guess it is. As I understand the regulation, it's this, and how the facts of this case unfolded, that the legislation was passed around 1985, the statute that we're dealing with now. In 1990, it came to light that there was some disturbance of this area and that this area was an effigy mound. And then, per the regulation, someone notified the Historical Society, and they notified the owner, and the owner was given an opportunity, now I tie into the language you're talking about, to, after Shea was notified of the presence of the burial site on his property, but before the site was cataloged, petitioner could have requested the director to approve excavation of the site to remove and analyze any human remains and related objects found in the burial site, citing 157.70 sub 4 sub C sub 3 sub A. So what you're talking about is before it's even cataloged. Isn't your petition that we are addressing here today to decatalog?
It is to decatalog.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The opinion, and I'm reading from the opinion of the Circuit Court, after such archaeological excavation and analysis, petitioner then could have sought continuation of its quarry activity, citing 157.74D, but you didn't exercise that, the opinion here states. You could have appealed the decision to catalog the site by requesting an administrative contested hearing under 227.42, but that wasn't done either. So the excavation that's authorized is pre-cataloging, isn't it?
I disagree.
Okay.
There's two statutory and a regulatory method to get that excavation permit. One is a permit to disturb, which you'll be hearing about
later
today.
Yeah, that's something different.
Exactly.
Okay. We're talking about the petition to decatalog.
Right. The other one is 2.04. This is a administrative code. It's disturbing burial sites, and sub 2 talks about testing. And that if there is reason to believe that a burial site may be present, the director may authorize orally or in writing limited appropriate subsurface exploration to determine whether a property contains a burial site.
In order to catalog it.
It does not state that it's limited to that purpose. In fact, if you look further down that regulation, there is an entire section on how to deal with uncatalogued burial sites and a further section, separate section, on how to deal with catalogued burial sites.
Yeah, there's a different procedure depending on the stage at which you enter the
but
equation.
The testing provision falls outside either of those other categories. I see my time is up.
Yes, just that's fine, and you'll have some time in rebuttal. Thank you. Very, very interesting. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel?
If it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Maura Whale and appearing for the Burial Sites Preservation Board. As many members of the bench have noted, there are really only two issues in this case: whether WNGRA presented sufficient evidence of the absence of human remains in the Ward Mound group, and whether the court may reweigh the evidence presented to the director on the human remains question. Our brief explains that the phrase sufficient evidence refers to the quantum of evidence needed to satisfy the applicable burden of proof in a given case. Sufficient evidence is not itself an evidentiary burden. And thus, in the most familiar context in a criminal case when a defendant says there wasn't sufficient evidence to support my conviction, the court looks to see whether there was evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to support his conviction. They don't think of the more vague term sufficient evidence. And I agree with the Chief Justice, maybe it would have been more helpful if the code provision had said preponderance rather than sufficiency of the evidence. I note that in the new statute, which moves the removal procedures from the code provision to the statute, also maintains the sufficient evidence language.
Well, the new statute also does something very significant for this case, and I don't know whether we should consider that or not. It removes the director's ability to catalog something that is of archaeological interest, which he had the authority to do at the time these mounds were cataloged, correct?
Correct.
That's a big difference.
But we have worked under the understanding that the cataloging of the Ward Mound Group was based on the presence of burial sites in the mound group.
But my understanding is that at the hearing that argument was precluded, that they were not able to argue that there never was evidence that this was a burial site initially. And, of course, under the current statute, it didn't have to be a burial site to be cataloged.
Okay, so the first thing you said is that you understood that WINGRA was not permitted at the hearing to
argue
about evidence. Well, to clarify, when the removal petition was considered by the director, both the director and WINGRA presented evidence, and WINGRA did present evidence that the director considered in great detail, all of which was pulled together by their expert, Dante Frada.
My understanding was that he considered the evidence as to whether or not he believed that WINGRA had proved there were no human remains, but he refused to let them make the argument that there was no evidence to begin with that these mounds ever had human remains.
I think the way I understand what the director did was said, at this point, the burden is on the proponent of removal to prove the absence of human remains. That's the question being considered. The question of whether there were human remains justifying cataloging was a question for 1990.
I understand
that. In 2012.
That. Right, but that's why, or maybe that was not the sole reason why, WINGRA was not permitted to argue that back in 1990 there never was proof that there were human remains in these mounds.
Well, that is true that they're not permitted. I would say that they were not permitted to contest the original cataloging decision. And that seems to me under basic administrative and appellate law principles, absolutely correct. As I think Justice Bradley noted, and as we stated in our brief, there were many opportunities and many ways
statutory or an administrative rule that says they must challenge cataloging within a finite period of time? And if it is, would you point it to me? I haven't found it.
Well, there is a general principle that if a person is harmed by an administrative agency decision, they have specific remedies. They have a remedy to ask for a contested case proceeding, and they have a remedy of seeking judicial review pursuant to Chapter 227.
Are either of those remedies limited by time?
Yes.
Where is the limit by time?
Well, under Habermehl, if there isn't a decision arising from a contested case hearing, which would have been the case here, you have 6 months to seek judicial review. As for of an agency decision, as for a contested case hearing, I believe that would have been something that the WNGRA should have done before the cataloging decision was made.
Yeah, Habermehl was a certiorari review case, correct? And so you're just applying common law certiorari standards of six months. So okay. You're saying that applies here. They could only have sought common law certiorari review?
Well, it is our belief that they could only have sought administrative agency type review. However, if you want to look at their situation more generously and say, well, there could have been some common law tort property, some kind of statutory liability ground for challenging the cataloging decision, then they would have been subject to the 6-year statute of limitation under 89350, I think. And they didn't do that either. They didn't take any of their the remedies that they clearly had or arguably had. Turn it off.
Somebody's got a nice ring.
So, and I also wanted to, one thing counsel said is that in our brief, the society said if we had reopened the cataloging, the burden would have been on us. I don't think we ever said anything about if we had reopened the question. I also note that counsel said that the agents, that the code provision was inconsistent with the statute. And that's not true because prior to the new act, the statute never spoke to removal procedures at all. Those were just provided by the code provision. Another thing that counsel raised is, I think several members of the bench noted that he's asking you to reweigh the evidence considered by the director, and I think that's clearly what he's doing.
See, I think he's asking us to consider only that evidence that is site-specific.
Yes.
And what your argument is, well, that's one way of looking at it, but there was evidence that's generalized, and there's no reason not to consider that. Is that right?
Yes, and that's what I was, in fact, just going to address. He's essentially saying that the director shouldn't have considered the report from Dr. Roseborough at all. In other words, WNGRA is now telling this court that it does not believe Dr. Roseborough's report was relevant. This argument was not made before the director. It's a relevancy argument, so that is a forfeited argument. But moreover, the evidence about the presence of human remains in effigy mounds as a general matter is clearly relevant because it provides an inferential basis for the decision maker to conclude that human remains are probably present in this particular effigy mound. So I think that it's very it's a very weak argument to say that the director should not have even considered that evidence. I understand WNGRA thinks it's weaker evidence than the FRADA evidence. The director doesn't agree with that, but to say it shouldn't have even been considered, I think is really a non-starter. And as far as the WNGRA's FRADA evidence is concerned, in WNGRA's briefs, It has consistently said that the director didn't give it proper consideration, and I think I summarize the director's analysis in the brief, but I think the better thing to do is just go back to the director's decision, and meticulousness with which the director examined the FRADA evidence, I think it makes it beyond reproach. And
your position that we are to assume that the director, under his statutory directive of 157.70 parent 2 parent, did identify and record a burial site?
Yes.
Okay. So yes. We are to presume that.
Well, so that is what the director did. If the director put this in the catalog, he cataloged it as a burial site.
Well,
and that is a fact.
But he could catalog other things that are of archaeological interest, according to the statute at the time. Are we just to presume he didn't do that, or I have a little trouble with that?
I'm sorry, I'd have to go back deep into the record to know if that's what happened. My understanding throughout the case has been that he cataloged it as a burial site.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Just in terms of the director's analysis of Wingra's FRADA evidence, what the director concluded was that the scholarship that FRADA relied on did not support his conclusions, and that his own study that he personally did, his use of a GPR to locate three anomalies on the bird effigy, and then he did more scientific analysis of those anomalies and concluded that they weren't consistent with something that was only human or animal remains, which hardly says that it precludes human or animal remains. And then he also found features that he thought were consistent with old fire pits. Well, the scholarship shows that old fire pits are frequently found in close proximity to human remains. So even if the court were to say, well, let's wade in and reweigh the evidence, I think you'll conclude that the director did a very good job here.
Can you tell me what in the record you rely on for your determination that the director was operating under 157.70(2)(a) rather than 2B? And it's under 2B that areas of archaeological interest can be cataloged. What in the record can I look at to understand better what you're telling me?
So I actually can answer the question. On the first page of the director's decision,
okay,
the third paragraph of the introduction, the director says, pursuant to subsection A, the director cataloged the ward-bound group as a burial site. And pursuant to subsection B, the director also cataloged the Ward Mound group as an archaeological site.
So he did it both ways.
So he did it both, yeah.
Okay. All right, yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks for pressing that.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, no, I still have some time. So long. Any other questions?
What about improvidently Grant?
I'm sorry.
What about improvidently Grant, given the new legislation?
Well, I think that I feel that this case was improvidently granted regardless of the new act, because I think it's only about these two mundane issues of what does sufficient evidence mean and are you going to reweigh the evidence. I think that depend, and I see my light is on. I'll just quickly finish the answer. Whether the new statute implicates the improvidently granted question, I think really depends on how you decide to answer the questions that are presented. And so, most specifically, if you decide that there is something inherently not lawful or not constitutional, say, about the prior code provision, and now we have a whole new procedure in the statute, then that would seem improvidently granted. It would seem a waste of your time to be talking about what you see as flaws in the code provision that is no longer has any effect.
But, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, my name is Howard Shanker. I'm here on behalf of the Ho-Chunk Nation. And I was looking at this new legislation while I was sitting there, and there is one part that I'd like to point out to you. At 157.702C, let's see, whether it's C, A, then B, in determining whether to record a burial site, the director shall consider the following types of evidence from any person. Physical evidence is demonstrated by archaeological or written historical reports showing the presence of human remains or grave markers. So what was introduced previously is evidence of human remains, statistical evidence, and in fact, Rossbow's report showed that where you had multiple mounds, such as in the Ward Mound Group, 100% of the time there were human remains there. But we don't even have to go there, because this new legislation says if you have evidence of a grave marker, you can catalog this as a burial site. And clearly there's evidence of a grave marker, which is defined as Indian mounds right above that. We felt this review was improvidently granted to begin with, but clearly with this new legislation in place that says if there's a grave marker, you can catalog it as a burial site, that's dispositive of that issue. With regard to the evidence, statistical or otherwise, regarding effigy mounds, and it clearly looks like this statute clarifies the fact that the legislature does intend to protect all effigy mounds, frankly. But that's not where we have to go here, because this effigy mound is a cataloged burial site. It was cataloged properly in 1990. We don't have the evidence in front of us. That's why you can't appeal it. It's 30 years old. It's stale. There was no appeal at the time. But again, it was cataloged. It was surveyed. WNGRA participated in the process, was informed on the process, and chose not to appeal at the time. So what you have in front of you right now is a cataloged burial site where WNGRA is trying to apply to remove it from the catalog.
What about our agreeing with your argument that there's human remains and then seeing whether those human remains could be removed to another site that would be approved by the Ho-Chunk Nation?
I doubt that it would be approved by the Ho-Chunk Nation. If you wanted to dig up my grandmother and move her somewhere else, I would be offended.
Well, and we dig up other people's grandmothers, and we do move them someplace else.
Well, if you want to dig up everybody's grandmothers and dig up the sand and gravel underneath them, that's the state's prerogative. But you've got legislation in place that precludes that. And there's a reason.
Well, it does permit removal of remains. That's part of the legislation. And my understanding of the Ho-Chunk's position is that there are no circumstances under which they would acquiesce to removal of any part of these mounds, whether they contain human remains or not. Is that correct?
I don't know that we have to go there, because these do contain human remains. But it's also a sacred site for a number of reasons. And generally, I would assume the court, or at least the legislature, would try to avoid desecrating a sacred site if it had that ability.
Okay.
Now, I want to address also the comment about conflicting evidence.
Say that again, please.
The comment about conflicting evidence. because there really is no conflicting evidence. Wingra presented no evidence that this site does not contain any human burials. And the director is very clear about that. So even if you exclude everything else, there is no evidence here presented by Wingra, Frata, or anybody else that this site does not include human burials.
But isn't the standard that we are looking at today a little bit different than that?
I think there has to be evidence. What was that term? Because it's not one I know of in another statute, okay?
If the director decides there is sufficient evidence to indicate that a catalog site does not contain any burials. So it doesn't say anything about proving anything. And that's what I have trouble with, is that standard, and I'm trying to line it up with what the director did. Now, there is evidence to indicate it doesn't contain human remains if you just look at what Ringgrove's presenting.
That's not true, Your Honor. What Ringgrove presented does not provide any evidence that there are no human remains.
What
it provides is evidence that there were three ferromagnetic anomalies.
You're using prove, and I'm stuck on the word indicate.
It doesn't indicate. It doesn't indicate anything. And when you're looking at questions of fact or weighing the evidence, you're supposed to be applying a substantial evidence standard of review, which is highly deferential to the administrative agency. You're not here to weigh the facts or the evidence.
No. But we are to decide what the law means.
Certainly.
Right?
And if you look at sufficient evidence, it's actually clear on its face. It gives the director the discretion to decide whether or not a party has provided sufficient evidence. They argue that that's unconstitutionally vague, that no one could possibly understand that, that it gives them unfettered discretion. Well, sufficient evidence is a pretty common term. Black's Law Dictionary defines it as such evidence in character, weight, or amount as will legally justify the judicial or official action demanded. Webster's defines sufficient as enough to meet the needs of a situation or a proposed end. And here, the director is vested with the discretion to determine whether or not a party submitted sufficient evidence. And frankly, if you look at this as unconstitutionally vague, it's going to have extremely broad ramifications because there are literally hundreds of statutes and regulations in Wisconsin that rely on this sufficient evidence standard. So, for example, under Veterans, Wisconsin Statute 986.085, 2D, in determining whether to issue a citation, the law enforcement, Veterans is 45.51B3. A person may be admitted to a veteran's home if he has not been convicted of a felony or crime involving moral turpitude, or if so has produced sufficient evidence of subsequent good conduct and reformation of character as to be satisfactory to the department. Under criminal procedure, Wisconsin Statute 85307, C2, paragraph B does not apply if any of the following applies. There's sufficient evidence that the testator intended the full transfer to take effect. And it goes on. Supreme Court rules. Supreme Court Rule 22.34, Medical Incapacity Proceeding, subsection 6A. Upon completion of an investigation, the director may do one or more of the following. Dismiss the matter for lack of sufficient evidence to believe that attorney has a medical incapacity. Supreme Court Rule 2205, Disposition of Investigation, 1A.
Counsel, I don't think sufficiency of the evidence is a burden of proof. And I am concerned with trying to figure out what is the burden of proof the law requires us to apply to this case. So if you could maybe direct yourself to that, that would probably help me a little bit
more. Sure. The discretion is on the director to determine whether or not the evidence was sufficient. Logically,
but what is the burden of proof by which he must make that determination?
Logically, it makes sense for a preponderance of the evidence, because if Winger comes in and says, demonstrates that it's more likely than not that this site contains human remains, therefore you should grant removal, that doesn't make much sense.
Okay, so that's the burden of proof that the director had defined in order to make his decision.
But based on the standard of review, there are certain cases that give the director even broader discretion, because the cases indicate that in certain instances there may be two sides that both have sufficient evidence, and it would be up to the director to decide and weigh the evidence. So there is an element of discretion in there. And I can provide you citation for that as well, if you like. So under Holtz v. Krause, Holtz and Krause v. DNR, 85 Wisconsin 2nd at 204. The court must affirm findings supported by substantial evidence, even one against the greater weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. In Robertson Transportation v. Public Service, 39 Wisconsin 2nd at 657 to 658, there may be cases where two conflicting views may each be sustained by substantial evidence. In such a case, it's for the agency to determine which view of evidence it wishes to accept. Now, there really is no conflicting evidence here. Winger produced no evidence that this site does not contain human remains, and that's clear from the director's decision. Now, I'd also like to address the point of evidence. First of all, the new statute, new legislation makes clear that the type of evidence, the statistical evidence, the archaeological reports, the evidence of the grave markers is all allowable and indeed dispositive. Here, and bear with me for 1 second, I'll read a brief quote from you. It says, the statutes governing administrative proceedings mandate that hearing examiners, or the director, admit all testimony having reasonable probative value. He's citing Wisconsin Stat 227.451. Quote, an administrative body enjoys even wider latitude than a court in admitting and considering proffered evidence. That's a quote from Winger's brief in the other case at page 70. I'll omit the citations, but clearly this evidence is admissible. Finally, I see my time is running. I did want to just point out that Winger also makes a substantive due process claim. And in our brief, we pointed out that the rational basis test applies to substantive due process. Winger, and that rational basis test is as follows. That government action must be upheld if there's any reasonably conceivable state of facts that could supply a rational basis for the classification. The rational basis test is not subject to courtroom fact-finding and may be based on rational speculation unsupported by evidence or empirical data. The burden is upon the challenging party to eliminate any reasonably conceivable state of facts that could provide a rational basis for the classification. Now, rather than provide some reasonable facts, Winger simply says that the rational basis test does not apply. Let me just give you one quick citation. State v. Smith, 323 Wisconsin 2nd, 377 at 391. And there are many cases, but that's a Supreme Court case that specifically applies the rational basis test to a substantive due process claim. And I would also like to point out one other case, which I just thought might be helpful. It's actually a New Mexico case, but it does a nice survey on why rational basis as opposed to strict scrutiny is applied in the deprivation of a property interest case. And that's Sweppy versus Mora County, 81 F sup 3rd, 1075 at 1174 to 1175. If there are no further questions. Thank you.
Your Honors, thank you. I want to address a number of points. First, regarding the time limit, the Society's own regulation provides for no time limit, and in fact, it takes away any time limit when it says if evidence ever is presented, and that's exactly what Winger did in this case.
Justice Bradley. So with regard to time limit, as I recall the decision of the director of the Historical Society, he indicated initially that there's a six-month limitation that was applicable.
That would have been
with regard to the 1990.
With regard to the 1990, but a removal petition can be brought at any time, and that's exactly what we did. And we believe all the evidence we produced is consistent with that petition. With regard to the burden of proof under that regulation, Justice Bradley, I think you were reviewing what the burden of...
Just a moment.
Yes.
So I just want to clarify, because things... there's a lot going on here. So you're focusing on the removal petition and the administrative rules attendant to a removal petition, that is, removing from the catalog. You're not focusing, then, on whether or not the initial decision was wrong, because there are limitations attendant to the disagreement with that decision as set forth in the director's decision in this case. Am I correct or incorrect?
You are correct, but we don't need to fall within those earlier statutory timeframes relating to that in order to have a new look at the cataloging, which is what the removal petition allows. As far as the burden of proof, I think you were reviewing part of the regulation. I think what you were actually reciting from was the director's decision about the burden of proof under the regulation. The regulation itself says nothing about whose burden it is and how the burden shifts. That's the director's
intention. I think I was referring to the circuit court's decision.
Which quoted the director's decision. And so none of that was in the actual regulation that we're dealing with now. The burden shifting position of the state, it's on pages 25 and 26 of their brief, where they do say if we decide to reopen, then we'll have the burden. But if we decide not to, then you have the burden. At their whim, they can decide who carries this burden. As far as the new legislation, I would disagree that it now protects grave markers and is, in essence, an effigy mound protection act. Grave markers remain under the new legislation, an indication supporting recording. If you go to the very next section, 2G, you can contest that recording. If you were not able to, if a grave marker in and of itself was merited protection, there would be no reason to have that as a marker and then contest that designation as a burial site. Here we have a presumption, at most, from the 1990 decision that there was statistical evidence, whatever its state might have been. Most of that evidence came decades later. And perhaps there would be a rebuttable presumption. The Fratta report rebutted that presumption. So we go to the state and say, what else do you have? We have the Fratta report. And they have nothing. And you can tell from their language and their decision that they applied the sufficient evidence standard at a much higher level requiring conclusive proof. When Professor Fratta, looked at the three anomalies that the Ho-Chunk had identified as potentially human remains, he concluded more likely than not, they are not human remains. And when you look at the decision and what we were faced with, what Winger was faced with, the director was concluding, well, maybe the Fratta report says what it says, but you didn't demonstrate that there are not also remains present at other locations, not remains present at locations below the mound. He set up a couple of examples. So I guess in essence, we needed to prove not just there weren't burial sites in the mound, but we needed to go below the mound into other locations that never have been claimed to have burial sites to satisfy the director. That's conclusive proof.
One of the things that this new legislation does is repeal 15772B. And my recollection is that that has been relied on in this case, 2B.
2B is the standard that allowed them to catalog archaeological sites and areas that likely contain human remains. So this revision actually tightens up the board's ability to catalog burial sites, mm-hmm. more so than what was present at this time.
What do you think is the burden of proof here, and who had it for removing this site from the catalog?
I'm out of time, but I'd be happy to answer your question.
Yes, please.
The burden of proof to demonstrate that a site contains human remains begins and is always with the director. People can bring removal petitions, but that leaves it up to the director to demonstrate by preponderance of the evidence that there contains human remains. In this case, the burden was inappropriately shifted and elevated to require WNGRA to conclusively establish that there were not human remains. And that's the problem with the decision.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for a really, really interesting case. We have more of this after lunch. I don't know if we'll have the same counsel or not, but it's fascinating. So, and the briefs were wonderful on all sides. You all did a very, very good job. So we're going to take a brief recess, well, a little bit more than brief. We'll be back at 1:30 for the second WNGRA case that we will hear today. We are adjourned.